Good afternoon. So last time, we finished going through what system calls do in XV6. We talked about how we have this user space wrapper function. We have this table that the processor actually read, which had an entry for all system calls. And XV6 decided that all entries in that table end up calling this trap function. That trap function looks at the code that corresponds to the particular exception and finds out if it was a system call, calls a system call handler function, which looks up in a table to decide what actual service code to run, code that like reads or writes or so on. We also mentioned other exceptions in XV6 where this first part of the process is the same, and the only difference is what the trap function does. So we started talking about context switching, and we'll finish that up today and hopefully make things clearer than last time. So any questions about stuff from last time other than context switching, which I promise we will have a chance to talk about later? Yeah.
Can I ask a question involving the quiz that was
today? Yes.
Are interrupts not considered system calls?
Question is, are interrupts not considered system calls? Yes. So when we say a system call, we mean something that a user program does to trigger a kernel service. Yes. Whereas interrupts include things like I press a key, no matter what the program's doing, the OS handles that key press. You know, it's things that aren't about what the program is asking the OS to do. Other questions? Okay. So there's a homework, which is implementing a system call in XV6, which is due on Friday, which hopefully you are aware of. There are office hours this week if you want help. This is probably the simplest homework, except depending on how much time it takes you to get familiar with XV6, how easy that is for you. Basically, you're going to add a write count system call, which counts the number of times the write system call is called across all processes, not just killer one. And we have a hint in the write-up that probably the easiest thing to do is look at some other kind of similar system call and imitate what it does. So there's several tables and lists you'll need to add it to. And the second part of the assignment is you need to create a user space program that actually calls your system call. Otherwise, how would you know if it worked? And that's the assignment. So a note that the existing code for uptime that we tell you to look at uses acquire release. You don't need to do this. This is for multiprocessor support. We don't care about multiprocessor support for this assignment. So you can ignore when you're copying from what uptime does all the acquire release stuff for now. Okay. So any questions about that before I start talking about context switches more? Okay. So last time when we were now context switches, we had our kernel context switch function. So we said that in the XV6 kernel, they made the decision that every process is going to have its own kernel stack. And when we're switching from one process to another, the first part of that is that we're going to save on this kernel stack a bunch of registers to call switch because of the calling convention. And then switch is going to remember its return address on the stack because of the calling convention, save all the other registers, and then it's going to change the stack pointer. And when we change the stack pointer, we can think of that as moving to the new thread. And the first thing we're going to do in the new thread is we're going to restore the old registers and then use the return address to jump somewhere. So we're going to start executing where switch was previously called. And in the case where we're starting a completely new thread, well, we don't have any place where switch was previously called, but we do this trick of just writing out the saved address that it's going to read for return manually to a location that we know has assembly code that will do what we want. That's how we start a new thread. We just write out the stack as if we had called switch. And in particular, to call switch at the exact location we wanted so that when we start switch to that thread, it will do something useful. We'll talk about what that useful thing is later. Okay. So that's the kernel space context switch. So we have the switch function, which saves the registers, moves to a new kernel stack. And that's what we were doing. Now, we also have a user space part that I didn't get to. So I started off by saying we have a thread in the kernel with its own stack, its own registers. We're running in kernel mode, like handling an exception. And we're in the middle of that exception, like a timer interrupt. We're going to switch to another kernel stack with its own registers that was from another program running. And we're doing this because ultimately, we want to run, say, user code associated with that program. But to do that, we're going to have to return from an exception. And what happens here is that, remember, when we started using the kernel stack, we did it because an exception happened. So the user space part of things is going to be stored on this trap frame struct we already saw. That when an exception happens, we save all the user stuff on the kernel stack. Then later on, when we decide to switch to another process, we first change to the other kernel stack. And then later on, we decide we want to get out of kernel mode, so we read that trap frame structure and then switch back to user mode using those values, restoring the user registers. So basically what's going to happen is that we have our user program is running. It has stuff on its stack, it has main's return address, main's variable stored on the stack, and possibly some other functions. Then an exception happens, like a timer interrupt goes off. And XV6 is going to say, okay, I need to save the user register, so it's going to save them, and that's going to be, this is going to be our trap frame. And we have the return address of trap. And then we have all the stuff that's being used to handle that exception. So the local variables where we're deciding, hey, what do I want to do next now that a timer interrupt happened? And eventually the thing we decide to do next is call the switch function. So we call the switch function and switch to another program which we think is better to run. And we start by switching to its kernel stack. So when we do that, we save the location to go back to this victim program here. There's switch return address. We save all the registers we need. And then we switch over to the new stack, which is already prepared to return from switch. So we have registers which were saved earlier when, for example, the program we're switching to was stopped by a different timer interrupt or a system call or something. And we read those registers, we restore them, and we read this other return address to know where was that program previously. And eventually, that program is going to decide to return from the trap function. And as it does that, we're going to restore the user registers and go to the other program's user stack. And in the process of doing this, we need to change the address space, and that's something we'll talk about later when we talk about address spaces. It's going to be one of the steps. So questions on what's on this picture? Yeah?
So what exactly is the difference between the trap return address and the switch return address? Where do they point to?
So the trap return address, this always points to code to return from exception, because that's when trap is called. This depends what the program was doing. So for example, if we switched away from the program because it called read and there wasn't input ready, we'd end up going back to a different place when we restarted it than if we switched away from the program because of a timer interrupt. Because after we switch back when it's reading, we went to finish the read. After we switch back from the timer interrupt, we just want to start the user space code directly. So depending on what the next thing to do in the program in the kernel is, we'll have different return addresses from switch. Yeah?
So potentially, could you go to the switch return address and then directly to the trap return address?
So the question is, potentially, could you go from the switch return address directly to the trap? Yes.
Okay.
Potentially. That's a thing which could happen. In practice, it probably won't. And the reason it won't is because of this address space switch that needs to happen. So we'll go to code which does the address space switch, then return from trap. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So is the trap return address always in like the user space, and the switch return address always in the kernel space?
So the question is, where are these things? So all this stuff is kernel in here. So the trap return address, that's kernel code.
Or rather, where are they pointing?
So the trap return address always points to kernel code. In particular, if you remember, it can be, I don't have it with me. So if you remember when we called, we had some code in assembly code which did a all traps, which did a call trap. The trap return address points here. So it's the code immediately after that assembly that wraps, that handles the exception immediately and then calls our C code. So that's always in the kernel, and it's always the same code in the case of XV6. And all that code does is it reads the saved user registers, which includes the saved user PC. So that's, I guess, not clear here. So this trap frame, this includes the user program counter. So that trap return address points to code, which is going to read that and go back to the user program at that location. Other questions? So perhaps a better way of visualizing this is that our program is running in user mode. We're running in user mode for a while. Then something happens that makes us switch to kernel mode. Like a system call could do it. An interrupt could do it. Something makes us switch to kernel mode. And we start the trap handler, and the first thing we do is save the user registers on the kernel stack. And we do whatever we have to do for the exception. And at some point during that, we might decide, oh, I don't want to keep running this program anymore. I'm going to switch to another one. So the first thing we do is we call switch to switch the kernel's registers and kernel stacks to the other program. Then we do some whatever logic that program needed to finish up in kernel, like maybe it's in the middle of a read, it needs to finish the read, or maybe it just needs to return and go back to user mode as fast as possible. But whatever it needs to do, we do that. And then when we're done, we exit the trap handler in this new program, switch to user mode running a different program. Yes? Question is to switch between two different programs. On XV6, you always have to go through, as XV6, as we'll be talking about things, you always have to go through the kernel. Now, in user mode, you could change your stack pointer. So you could have a switch function in user mode. But as far as the kernel is concerned, it's just one program, even though it changes its stack pointer in weird ways. Okay. Other questions? Can the user prompt the switch to happen? Yes. So for example, if I ask to read from the keyboard and there's no input ready, the OS is probably not going to switch back and have me keep running. It doesn't make sense. I'm waiting for the read to happen, so it's going to switch away. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this is our next switch. And we'll talk about later, there also needs to be a change in the address space. And in XV6, that's basically going to happen somewhere around here, is an address space change. We'll talk about that later on when we talk about virtual memory. Okay. the scheduler, possibly sooner than that. When we talk about the scheduler, we'll talk about when that happens. Okay, so we've talked about exception handling. So there's one little thing I like to mention, which is that let's say we have our, oh, I do have the code. We have our call to trap, we're in the middle of trap. You know, so let's say the program has made a system call here, you know, we called read, made the read system call, and then at this point, I have a key press. Okay. So this is something which can happen, in which case, the way it's going to work in XV6 is that we'll have two trap frames saved on the kernel stack, and we'll just keep using it. So, and the XV6 rule basically is that we switch to the kernel stack if we're switching from user to kernel mode. If we're already in kernel mode, we keep the stack pointer the same. Now, this is useful for like if this is a read system call and a key press, but there are some issues with this. So let's say we have, you know, a key press and another key press. Do we want to have this nest arbitrarily deeply? So the question is, how much deep can this nesting be? Like, how many nested exceptions can we have? If I have like 20 disks hooked up to my machine, can I have 20 different interrupts for each of them in sequence? And processors have a feature to allow the OS to keep this in check. So the CPU supports disabling interrupts. So we can say, while I'm handling this, you know, key press, I don't want to also handle a timer interrupt and a disk read finishing. I want to wait, so I'm going to disable interrupts until I'm done. So the CPU has some state for this. And an important decision when you make an OS is what sort of things you're going to allow to disable interrupts. Because the concern is, let's say I take a long time to handle like a disk read. You know, that means that I'm not going to be able to respond as quickly to a key press. So this is an important design decision from that perspective. So XV6 has made a policy about this. And XV6's policy is that they're going to allow a system call to be interrupted by something. So this means that if I have a slow system call, like I'm reading a giant chunk of thing, from that we're going to allow like key presses to interrupt that and timer interrupts to interrupt that. But otherwise, we're going to disable them. So this means that if I have a key press, I'm not going to allow start handling the key press and then handle something else in the middle of that until I'm done handling the key press, until I've stashed the information away somewhere and I'm ready to keep running whatever was running. And the big advantage of this policy is that it makes XV6 a lot easier to code. It's really annoying to write code which can be interrupted by something else. So XV6 goes through the effort to make this work for, like, I have the read from keyboard interrupt in the middle of my read system call. But to do that, it actually needs to do something to make sure it doesn't get confused about whether it read something from the keyboard or not. And we'll talk about that later when we talk about synchronization. But by at least eliminating the possibility of like having a timer interrupt in the middle of handling a key press, we don't have to worry about what program was I running in the middle of the timer interrupt. We know it's the same, we aren't changing it. So this simplifies coding XV6. But this advantage is that, you know, if you want to do something like guarantee a minimum reaction time to a key press, this might not be so great because now I need to worry about all the non-system call things, how slow are they? Because that's my reaction time to a key press. If I take a millisecond to handle the disk being ready with data, then I'm going to take a millisecond to handle a key press, potentially, if you just have bad luck. So that's the disadvantage of this scheme. Okay. So any questions about this? Yeah.
So it's necessary to have these kind of policies? Is it that if you had exceptions tested too deep, you could have a Stack Overflow and a kernel stack?
So the question is, if you had exceptions tested too deep, you could have a Stack Overflow. So you have to plan for how deep it could be. So you can limit it because you know there's only so many types of exceptions, so many devices. So you just have to plan to make sure you have enough. In the case of Xv6, an advantage of this scheme is that their planning is I need to handle 2. And like that's not so bad. But if you think of like I need to handle 16, then you might need to start worrying a lot more about how much stack space am I using. Okay, so since we just talked about context switches, here's an exercise. So I have a nice XV6 program here, which I've written in assembly. We have a loop which counts up an EAX and does nothing else. And XV6, it has a timer interrupt, so it's going to switch away from this program. And we have this EAX. Where is that going to be stored when it switches away? I'll give you a minute to tell me. Switches away, it's starting running another program. Where is that value stored? And you can check with your neighbor. Thank you. questions? Yes.
This is just more of a general question, but what if in the child process, can you fork inside the child process, and how's that handled?
The question is, can you fork inside of a child process? Absolutely. A child process is still just a normal process. There's no distinction between the two. So you can keep doing that. Eventually, you'll run out of memory if you fork too much, because you can only have so much memory for programs. But yeah, you can keep doing it. Yes?
Why does the
NF go
through
the sequence? I didn't get your question. So this if statement greater than zero, why doesn't, what happened? The question is, why is it entering both the if statements? So we have two programs that are running. So this program, this process, the one with this control block and these registers, enters the first if statement. The other one, this program with these registers, enters the second one. And I showed an example output. It's not actually determined what the order of the output is. That could happen in either order. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
So is it just a zero in the child PID instead of for setting up? Why does it change to 432 later on?
So the question is, why does it change to 432 later on? So the way to think about this is that we have a single thread running, and we split that into two threads. So it's not that it changes later on, it's that we have one thread where it's zero and one where it's 432. So we're running in the program copy of the process where it's 432, it's going to be 432 all the time. We're running in the process where it's zero, it's going to be zero all the time. It's kind of as if we started two copies of the program, like we ran foo space zero enter, foo space 432 enter. Like, kind of like that. Just have two programs running at the same time. That's the effect of calling fork. So it's not that it changes back and forth. We in fact have, you know, two copies of all the registers and different program. Sometimes we're running the original program and we're using the original copy. Sometimes we're running the copy and we're using a different set of registers. Other questions? Yes.
When you're calling get PID, it will never return that zero from the AX.
When you're calling get PID, yes, it will never return that zero. The zero is just a placeholder to tell you you're in the child. So we could have had an API where I have to do something like, you know, child PID, you know, doesn't equal parent or whatever, where we return a different number. Or like we could have had an API where like we returned a Boolean, comma, child PID or something like that, but POSIX decided not to do that, probably because it's annoying to do that in C. Yeah?
So would that output, you've got the parent print first, and then the child print next, is that always going to be the case?
The question is the parent always going to print before the child? Absolutely not. Okay. Other questions? Well, and with that question in mind, here's a program. Give me two possible outputs. And check with your neighbor. And you can assume this doesn't crash or anything like that. Thank you. And if it makes things easier, there are more than two possible outputs, so you aren't like looking for the only possibility. There are lots of answers. Who needs more time? Okay. So can someone give me a possible output? Any one possible output? Oh, no volume, yes.
In child 100, undone.
Okay, so in child 100, done. So that is a possible output. And the way this would happen is that we call fork, and then our child runs, and then we have a context switch to the parent, and then we have another context switch to the child again. That would be a way that could happen. Because after fork, remember, we have two programs, and just like, you know, we aren't going to run an infinite loop forever, we're going to switch between them, and we don't really have any guarantees in when that happens, and that's where all the possibilities come from. And I have a couple others with the patterns we could have that could cause that. So we could have the parent could end up doing its print first, and we have the same sort of pattern. So parent prints out, child prints out, parent prints out done, child prints out done, parent exits. We could have the parent print out, we get the parent run fork, the child print out, and then the parent print out everything. That would be valid, and this just depends on when we switch between programs, which is going to depend on timing and what other events are going on in the system. So in practice, you'll see all sorts of variations of this on pretty much any system. Yes?
Does parent always start running first after fork?
So the question is, does parent always start running first after fork? No. In this picture, I always have parent first because the assumption is that fork is running like here. So a parent has to be running to run the fork. And that's the reason I put parent first. Yeah?
Is it possible for the prints to trip over each other?
So the question, is it possible for the prints to trip over each other? As far as we know, yes. So this is why I said there are many possible outputs. So you could imagine that maybe a possible output is like in you know, something like this would be part of a possible output because of that. I think that's unlikely, but yeah, there's nothing preventing that. Yeah.
So the parent and the child, after you call fork, how do both know which line of code to run next?
So the question is, after the parent and child call fork, how do they both know which line of code to run next? So fork is going to change the return value, which is EAX. It happens on x86. So they're both going to check EAX. One of them is going to find out it's zero, one of them's not. And that means when they both execute this exact same if statement, they're going to do different things. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've created new processes, but not in the way that you typically think of creating new processes of like, I want to run LS. So how do we actually run programs? And that's done with a different set of functions, which I've marked as exec star. There's a whole bunch of functions whose names start with exec, which all do basically the same thing, but take their arguments in slightly different ways. And this is the way we do it, POSIX. And what the exec functions do is they replace the current program, the current process, with a new program. This new program has the same PID, but a new process image, meaning a new values in memory. Like, we completely change the contents of memory when we call this, but the process ID is the same. We just overwrite all the relevant values in our current process control block. And this is typically used with fork. So the pattern you'll most often see is we fork to create a new process, and the thing that new process does, which is now a copy of the original, is the first thing we do is get rid of everything and replace it with this new program. So we create a copy only to completely discard almost all of that copy with a new program. So what that might look like is this. So here I fork in the child process, I'm going to run exec, and I'm running execing. The program has been ls, and I need to say what arguments I'm passing. That's the second set of arguments to execv. And when execv succeeds, it's going to start running that new program at its main. So the only reason I would get to this line immediately below execv in the child process is if it failed. For example, if binls didn't exist. In which case, what I'm doing here is printing an error and exiting anyways. And note that we have these arguments, and this is used to set, when we run that main, the initial values of argv and argc. So, questions about this code? Okay, so we have execv, we take the file name of the program to run, and the values for argv. And typically the file name should match the values you pass for argv, but it's not actually required. Okay, so what exec does is when we run exec, we're running our program, and it's just going to replace everything, all the registers with the initial values they're supposed to have when a program starts. It's going to set up a completely new memory for the program, including loading the stuff from the executable for it. And we're going to copy over the arguments onto the program stack from the arguments to execv. Any questions here? So this is what I mean by replacing. We like literally just allocate the memory for the new program, discard the old one. We just need to save the arguments somewhere as we're doing that. Yeah. So yes, with what we showed before, it seems like we have three programs loaded at once to do this. We can probably do a bit better by copying the arguments first, then removing the original program, then making the copy if we could do that. But yeah, it seems like we're spending a lot of space. We'll talk later on when we talk about virtual memory about why it's not as bad as it sounds. Yeah.
What is kept intact when you hear exec?
So the question is, what's not changed? Well, the biggest thing which has not changed are the open files. Those stay the same. And this is useful because one of the open files is like the terminal. And we sure would like the new program to be able to output to the terminal, and this is how it can do that. And that things like this are kept intact is a big reason why, you know, why we have these open files kept intact, why you might think that the fork exec model is useful. Because now we have a way of specifying what files does the program have access to that we're running without needing to add extra arguments to our run the program system call. We just specified the program to run and its arguments. We didn't have to specify the program to run its arguments and its initial input, output, and so on. That's already built in. And that's probably why POSIX went with this fork exec model rather than something like what Windows does, where Windows has a system called create process, basically, which has lots and lots of arguments because you want to specify what files does it have open and so on. So any other questions about our exec call? Okay. So since you'll probably be using exec, a brief note about exec in C++. So exec's prototype for argv looks like this, and you probably don't deal much with const like this. So this is a pointer to constant, pointer to char. It probably should be a constant pointer to constant, pointer to char. And this is awkward in C++, which cares more about const than C does. So in C, you don't need to do anything. In C++, you get these errors. The solution to the error is to cast. And this is an unfortunate choice made by POSIX. I'm mentioning this just because it probably comes up a bunch on the next assignment after the first XV6 assignment, where you have to use execv. Just don't want you to waste your time decrypting that error message, especially since I don't expect anyone to know off the top of their head that argv is declared as a pointer to constant, pointer to char from that declaration. Okay, so there's another thing that POSIX has along with processes that you'll see occasionally called environment variables. So if I run the command printenv, it prints out a bunch of these key value pairs. And these are another thing which are by default passed to programs. And you can access them with these functions putenv, getenv, setenv. So this is one thing which is passed to programs. It's not overwritten by the exec call. And in fact, there's a variant of exec where you can pass completely new environment variables if you want to do that. If you use something like execv where you don't, it just keeps them the same. And this is something which, as far as the typical implementation, it's typically copied to the stack along with the arguments of the new program. And I'm mentioning these because you'll come across these when you're using Unix in practice, or probably already have. And this is all we're going to deal with them in this course, just mentioning they exist. Okay. So questions on environment variables? So I mentioned fork exec. We could just have a function spawn a new program. And Windows does this. And POSIX, in fact, has one called POSIX spawn. But it's relatively new. It wasn't implemented like for the first 40 years of Unix. 40, 50, yeah, years of Unix. And when it is implemented, it's often implemented pretty poorly. But it does exist. And it shows you the complication that it has to have ways of specifying what files do I want to open, what I want the current directory to be, what I want the environment variables to be. You have to specify all that in this one function call. Okay. So any questions about fork exec before we move on? So we talked about starting new programs, including making a new process, writing a different program, a different executable in that process. So the next thing we want to do probably is wait for that program to finish. If we think of running ls, we run ls and we want it to have it actually stop running. at some point, and then we want to ask for the next command. We don't want to do it while it's running. We don't want to have that interleaved output where I type ls, I get, you know, some files, and I get my prompt, and I get some more files, and then I type my next command, you know, cd. That's very annoying. We don't want that to happen. So how do we avoid that? Well, there's a system call for waiting for programs to finish. The one we'll typically talk about in this class is wait PID. So this has several arguments. So it waits for a particular program to finish. So it takes a PID to wait for. And when the program finishes, we have some information about what happened. Most notably, if you call exit or return from main, you have this zero or something else. You can exit one, exit zero. That number is transferred as part of this status. There's also other information. For example, if the program segfaults, the status will be set to a particular value to tell you it's segfaulted rather than exiting normally. There's also these options, which allow us to have wait PID behave differently. So we'll show you some examples of this. So one thing you can do is that, let's say you're running multiple child processes, or you don't care which one you're waiting for. You could specify a PID of -1, and that's equivalent to saying, wait for all the programs that I'm the parent of. Now, you can only wait for your child processes. So you can't wait for some other random program, even if you know its PID. You can only wait for programs that you forked and you were the parent process for. Okay. And in the options, most typically you'd pass 0. There's another option, which is this W no hang is the most commonly used option. And it says, this is not correct, to return 0 rather than hanging if a process doesn't complete. So this wait PID returns the process ID which completed. If you pass options of 0, it's going to hang. It's going to wait until something actually finishes. If you pass W no hang, it will just tell you what's done right now and let you go on doing what you're doing. What you want to do depends on whether you're waiting for something or you just want to like check if it's finished yet, and if not, move on to something else. So any questions about wait PID? Okay. And as is usually the case with POSIX functions, if you need to use this, I recommend the manual page or the POSIX documentation. Okay, so I mentioned exit statuses, too. That's where that comes from. So typical uses of wait PID might look something like this. This is the simplest possible thing. So we have a child process. The child process is probably executing something. And the parent, we want to not go move on until that child is finished. So we call wait PID with the child process ID and some place to store the status. And maybe we should look at it to figure out what happens. Yes? So if I do it via fork exec, so the question is, if this child execs, is it still a child? And the answer is yes. Yes, so you can wait on it. And in fact, this is the most common usage of wait. Is that you starting a different program, you want to wait for that different program to finish, that's how you do it. Yeah?
We're just going to wait for the child to finish. Why don't we just do it all in one process?
The question is, why don't we do it all in one process? Well, we have the problem that I mentioned about exec earlier, which is that if we get to here, then that means exec failed. So there's no time when control will return to our old program. Because remember, our old program, after we're done with exec, is gone away, the old child. Has gone away after we're done with exec, and if we exec in the parent, the whole parent process would go away. So we wouldn't be able to run again. So the whole purpose of having the new process is that our process which is waiting gets a chance to run, even though the child which we exact exits. That answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So, since you know about like exit zero and return zero, your guess would probably be that status is just the return value for main or the value passed to exit, and you'd be wrong. So there's some encoding of the exit status as an integer, and there's these macros which start with a W for wait for decoding them, which are in the header file. They're described in the manual page. So you can check if it exited normally and get the exit status using those. And it also encodes other information, which is why you can't just print it out, like if it terminated due to a seg fault, which you can find out from the status. And that's what this signaled case is. So you'll find out, like, if it terminated from control C, that will be sig int. If it terminated from a seg fault, that will be this sig seg v value. And that's how you determine that. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So next time we'll pick up on this.